Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the recent tiff between presidential candidate John McCain and General Wesley Clark, which has revived the Vietnam War. We'll examine John McCain's belief that the Vietnam War was winnable and look into what General Clark actually said in this era. Where it's more in this era of spin, where it's more important, not so much important what you say, but what the press says you said. We'll speak with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning over President Nixon's invasion of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. He's an award-winning investigative journalist and historian, author of several books, including Richard Milhouse Nixon, The Rise of an American Politician, and Money and Power, The Making of Las Vegas. And he also did an in-depth analysis of Donald Rumsfeld and Robert Gates, available online at Counterpunch and Tom Dispatch. His history of U.S. policy and covert intervention in South Asia and the Middle East, entitled Shadows of the Eagle, will be published by Knopf this year. We'll also look into the dysfunction of our national security apparatus, starting with Condoleezza Rice, who's largely responsible for the enormous vacuum in national security that has been filled by David Addington and Vice President Cheney. We'll also look into we'll also talk with Dr. Robert J. Lifton, who's one of America's most acclaimed psychologists, known for his studies of the psychological causes and effects of war and political violence. Dr. Lifton was quoted in this New York Times article just this week entitled China-Inspired Interrogations at Guantanamo, in which it is revealed that torture techniques used in Guantanamo were copied verbatim from a 1957 Air Force study of the Chinese communist techniques used during the Korean War to obtain confessions, many of them false, from American prisoners. And we'll also, in general, assess the damage done to U.S. foreign policy by torture and the erosion of our credibility in terms of human rights. And then we'll speak with Adam Isaacson, the director of the Columbia Program at the Center for International Policy, an independent research and advocacy organization in Washington, D.C., which monitors security and U.S. military assistance to Latin America and the Caribbean. And the project monitors U.S. military assistance to the Columbia, where $5 billion has, in fact, been sent. And we'll look into that, obviously, in the context of the spectacular rescue ruse used by the Colombian military to get out some of the most high-value hostages that the FARC were holding. Also, we look into the future of the FARC, which many people have suggested is disintegrating. Then in the second hour of Live from the Left Coast, we'll speak with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who will be talking about the reviewing the internal army report on the Iraq War. He is a decorated combat veteran from the first Gulf War, an acclaimed military analyst and historian, and we'll be talking to him about the Army's report and, in general, what is happening in Iraq. I'm now speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. Before resigning over President Nixon's invasion of Cambodia, he is an award-winning investigative journalist and historian. He's the author of several books, including Richard Milhouse, The Rise of an American Politician, and Money and Power, The Making of Las Vegas. And he's working on a new book that will be published later this year on U.S. foreign policy and covert intervention in South Asia and the Middle East, entitled Shadow of the Eagle. And as I was saying, Roger Morris, just that we live in this peculiar age of spin where it's not a question of what you say, but what the press says you said. And of course, last week, there was a dust up. There's been a dust up this week between Senator McCain, who's running for president, of course, and General Wesley Clark, which has revived the Vietnam War. John McCain believes that the Vietnam War was winnable. Let's begin with Clark's statement. What he said, of course, was not exactly how it was reported. But what is wrong with suggesting that perhaps flying a fighter plane and being shot down over Vietnam doesn't necessarily make you a wartime leader?
Well, there was absolutely nothing wrong with it, Ian. It's a sign, of course, of how vacant and utterly meaningless in many respects this political dialogue has become in the wake of our torrid primary campaign. I think we're in a kind of dead zone here, and Clark happened to be fair game for a media in search of a story. He's quite right that nothing in particular in John McCain's credentials in the military qualifies him to be president or commander in chief any more than any other POW. There obviously have been tens of thousands of them in American history would be necessarily qualified to be president of the United States. So that the whole debate, the whole issue was facetious in a sense.
Well, Paul Krugman pointed out this week in the New York Times that Al Gore never claimed that he invented the internet. Howard Dean didn't scream. Hillary Clinton didn't say she was staying in the race because Barack Obama might be assassinated. And Wesley Clark didn't impugn John McCain's military service. So is this a question that the truth is really a moving target, and it's really a question of who spins the best? And obviously Karl Rove was a hell of a lot better than anybody else at this.
Yeah, you know, the truth has really become not only a target but an endangered species in the internet age. We've spared no exaggeration here, no distortion, and we used to be able to rely on some, at least in the media, to draw these distinctions, to make these corrections, and to move on. Back before World War I, even the media then, even yellow journalism of the early 20th century, was a bit more responsible than this new internet age is in many ways.
So let me ask you then, how can anybody, and particularly Obama, get any traction? Obviously, Obama's in trouble here because as he moves to the center, he feeds the GOP charge of flip-flopping, which I think they'll clearly borrow from what they did to John Kerry. And of course, the American left is, a lot of the left is quite self-righteous, and as he appeals to the center, they're going to get more and more alienated. They want obviously perfection, and they're not going to get it. So we have this obviously puts him in jeopardy. But the long and the short of it is, I can't understand why Obama, I've always never understood why the Democrats, why Bush's mistakes have become the Democrats' problems. And he doesn't seem to be able to shake particularly this Iraq war and the extent to which he's talking about pulling out. I mean, clearly what's happening now, Roger Morris, is that the Iraq war has been successfully spun, because everybody in the press, all they talk about is how successful the surge is, not how unsuccessful the war is.
Well, I think the last 2 weeks have been a rather graphic sign of how appalling this whole dialogue has become. First of all, to talk about John McCain's view of Vietnam, or to talk at all in these terms about Vietnam, is such an awful denial of history. That was a major blunder, which has been documented ad nauseum now in American history. To discuss it in any other terms, to discuss the myopia toward Vietnamese nationalism, or the irrelevance of that war and of the absolutely wanton sacrifice of all of those casualties, is the height of intellectual and cultural irresponsibility, really. But you know, we saw just before that dust up with Clark and McCain, we saw Obama's principal foreign policy advisor and the former national security advisor to Bill Clinton, my old friend Tony Lake, give an interview to the Financial Times in which he said some very alarming things about the Democratic candidate's policy toward Iraq, and with references specifically to Vietnam. Tony saying, you know, we should have learned the lesson there that we need a stable and a decent government in place before we leave. A lot of politicians didn't understand that at the time. My goodness, this is an awful rewrite of history. I was there with Tony. We were writing memos to Henry Kissinger telling him that we needed to get out. This was when we were negotiating the exit in the latter months of 1969, early 1970, before the Cambodian invasion, and telling him in extremis that we should, even if we needed to, depose the South Vietnamese government in order to afford that exit. So Tony's rewriting history, and I think that the signs are not good that Obama is revising his Iraq policy as rapidly as he can toward the center and even toward the right in this traditional democratic surrender to what they imagine is the national security monster out there that will eat them before Election Day. But this is an increasingly irrelevant debate, Ian. You're quite right. The surge is an artificial contrivance to a large extent. We've bought off the Sunni tribes. We have bribed our way into a kind of equilibrium there, and the basic political realities in Baghdad are no different, and in fact, if anything, probably have decayed somewhat with al-Sadr's growth of power and influence, the undiminished influence really of the Iranians, whatever the threats are in that quarter, and the absolute irrelevance and waste of the American occupation. We're going to have to exit that country as we exited Vietnam. Wrong war, wrong place, wrong time, contrary to all our national interests. And meanwhile, no one is quite telling us what to do about gasoline that is going through the roof.
Well, at the risk of beating a dead horse, John McCain said in 1998, like a lot of Vietnam veterans, I believe, and still believe, that the war was winnable. And 5 years later, he said, we lost in Vietnam because we lost the will to fight, because we did not understand the nature of the war we were fighting, and because we limited the tools at our disposal. Let me turn to another extraordinary statement that took place this week. Condoleezza Rice was interviewed on Bloomberg, where she suggested that the Iraq war, she's proud of the Iraq war, and she also went on to say that how absurd it was for anybody to suggest that al-Qaeda was stronger now than it was before 9/11, which made me think, my God, you are the woman who was given a study from the National Security Council's counterterrorism people saying bin Laden determined to attack in the United States before 9/11, which you dismissed. So if bin Laden was so powerful and much more so than he is now before 9/11, why the hell didn't you do something about it?
Well, I know it sounds shocking, and almost every time this administration still opens its mouth, and Rice is just about the last to to venture into the public with these things, it sounds astonishing, but there's nothing really very surprising here. You know, this woman has been the single greatest intellectual failure at the upper levels of American foreign policy in a long time, and that's quite a distinction. She began her career as an analyst of the Soviet Union and mistook the fall of that empire, the whole meaning of perestroika and of the Gorbachev era. She continued right on through the post-Cold War period and making the same kind of mistakes. She was mistaken, of course, about almost every region of the world in the first Bush administration as National Security Advisor, and she continues to be just that disreputable and just that wrong in the second term as Secretary of State. Now, whatever else she is symbolically or politically, she's a disaster in substantive terms, and it's just very sad. All that can be said is that these people will be gone on January 20th or 21st. We need to worry a great deal, though, about who will replace them. Obama has assembled a group of national security advisors, a team here he's publicized with Madeleine Albright and Warren Christopher and Lee Hamilton. I mean, no derelict, no anachronism left behind in that group. Many of the same people who gave you the 1990s and the prelude to Condoleezza Rice, and many of those people, most of his key advisors, did not, of course, initially speak out against the war in Iraq, even as he did. So we're in for a long siege as usual. But Condoleezza Rice will I think mercifully vanish into the mists of history here, and will be very soon forgotten. But of course,
her blithe incompetence will not be forgotten.
Oh, it will haunt us.
Because for example, she secretly brokered that deal between Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto for Bhutto to come back as the prime minister and forgiving all of her and her husband's corruption charges, and then Musharraf would stay on as president, and then so Bhutto comes back, and what happens? They don't even bother to protect her, and she's killed. And now I think, and a lot of analysts in that part of the world think that Pakistan is truly going under. That, and that will of course mean that we'll never get out of Afghanistan, because the entire route in and out of Afghanistan goes through the Khyber Pass, through Peshawar. There's even a chance that Peshawar is going to fall to the Taliban. And as we speak, every bit of material that comes in and out for the American effort and all the NATO effort in Afghanistan goes through the same route that the drug smugglers used. And in effect, the United States government pays about $2,000 per truck to the drug dealers to get their stuff in and out.
You couldn't be more right. The real blunder, the real tragedy in the Afghan policy is that it was never anything more than the traditional Pakistan policy of the United States. And it goes back long, of course, before George W. and Condoleezza Rice, back to the 1970s. Our maintenance of that military dictatorship, whether it was overt or covert, has been the root of nearly all evil in South Asia, including the continuing arms race with the Indians, the clash over Kashmir, and all the rest. But we're facing a series of dead ends there, in which the Obama position is, of course, not appreciably better, and in some respects worse than John McCain's. McCain wants to keep the troops in the irrelevance and waste and tragedy of Iraq, and Obama wants to transfer them out to the irrelevance, waste, and tragedy of Afghanistan. Neither candidate, neither set of advisors on either side seems to have the slightest understanding of what you just articulated, which is the core of the problem. So military incorporated in Islamabad will be the root of our difficulty for a long time to come.
And what do you think, though, that this Condoleezza Rice, George W. Bush destruction of national security? Because it's not just that they mismanaged national security and fought the wrong war. They've also mismanaged the economy in such a wholesale way that this massive impoverishment of the United States is happening before our eyes. Huge amounts of money being transferred to the Saudis, the people who harbored, if you will, bin Laden, or at least produced him. They seem to be so. Nobody's putting the two and two together. This is a massive catastrophe, and the vacuum that Rice created in the National Security Council, since she was basically Bush's tutor and there was nobody running the store for the first 4 years, has allowed Cheney and Addington to take over. Obviously you won't get anything worse, but will you get anything better?
Well, that's what bothers me. I think you're right. This administration was in some respects a continuum from past blundering, but they, of course, have accelerated the process of decay and deterioration far beyond anything we might have imagined. We've got the worst of both worlds here in terms of a collapsing economy and all of these commitments and all of this blindness abroad. But I don't see, frankly, any hope at all in the conventional culture of foreign policy around the Democratic Party, or in the stable of advisors that Obama is relying on, inheritances from Tom Daschle and other creatures of the 1990s. This new president, and I think he will be president, I think it's going to be a blowout, Ian, quite frankly, but this new president is going to need extraordinary pressure from an informed citizenry, from activists on the outside who can operate under no illusions about who and what he is and is not. It's going to take a real mobilization of skill and of political sophistication as well as the right positions to try to pressure and force him. And he is a politician. He is uniquely sensitive to outside pressure. I think he will respond to core constituencies if it's a matter of reward and punishment. That's the best one can say about him. He's smart, and he's politic. And our work is cut out for us, but no one is going to rescue us on January 21st. No administration coming into power is going to be the answer to this, as you say, this unfolding tragedy.
Well, obviously, the chickens are coming home to roost, and in as much as we're getting a double whammy, we can no longer be the world's policeman and the world's banker, and both of those jobs are being eviscerated before our eyes. But given that, just in closing, Roger Morris, given that John McCain is pretty much dead on arrival, and I think you're correct in suggesting that this probably will be a blowout. In fact, I think the press is actually trying to make it more of a competition than it really is. But that still doesn't deny the possibility that in their desperation, the Republicans may try to do something towards the end. I mean, you've got this Iran resolution vote coming up this next week in the House, Resolution 362, where they're going to try and it's an AIPAC resolution that they're trying to push through, and the Senate, of course, is going to go along with it, suggesting that we should use military force against Tehran. That, of course, that suggestion echoes the former Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, himself a very high-ranking military official. Military exercises that the Israelis are conducting, the ordnance that the U.S. gave them in terms of those bunker buster bombs, etc., suggest a possibility. And of course, the reporting of Seymour Hersh continues to suggest that actually this insane thing will happen. And of course, if you think gasoline is high now, once we start bombing Iran, it'll cost you maybe $1,000 to fill your tank, as opposed to $100 now.
There are lots of alarming signs, although I think there are some encouraging ones. We have some reports out of Tehran that there may be some give there, and the Europeans are not entirely hopeless on this in terms of the package of incentives that they've offered and may be able to negotiate. I wouldn't put anything past this administration. I think we have to live under the gun here, as we haven't lived for a very long time, that a catastrophe could happen literally on the impulse of this pathology that inhabits the White House in the person of this duopoly of power, Bush and Cheney. Anything can happen. But I would hope at least that we could get through January 21st. I don't think, frankly, even an attack by the Israelis or jointly with the United States will save necessarily John McCain. But it certainly will create chaos in the United States. We're just in for a long winter season here, Ian, and I think we have to begin by understanding that Barack Obama's appearance and his seeming rescue here, even his election, is not really going to change that very much.
I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Roger Morris. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. He resigned over President Nixon's invasion of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. And we're talking both about the statements made by the presidential the Republican presidential candidate about Vietnam being winnable, and of course the dysfunction in our National Security Council. I'm now speaking with Dr. Robert J. Lifton, one of America's most acclaimed psychologists, known for his studies of the psychological causes and effects of war and political violence. Robert J. Lifton is the author of many books, including The Nazi Doctors, which was a winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, A Death in Life, Survivors of Hiroshima, which was the winner of the National Book Award, Destroying the World to Save It, Om Shoryukyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism, and Superpower Syndrome, America's Apocalyptic Confrontation with the World. That also dealt with the apocalyptic nature of George W. Bush's war on terror. Dr. Lifton was recently quoted in the New York Times in an article just this week entitled China-Inspired Interrogations at Guantanamo, in which it revealed that torture techniques used in Guantanamo were copied verbatim from a 1957 Air Force study of Chinese communist techniques used during the Korean War to obtain confessions many of course which were false from American prisoners. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Robert J. Lifton. At the time of that 1957 report, you wrote an article in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, did you not?
I had done, I did two studies. One was with other military psychiatrists. I was then doing my 2 years as an Air Force psychiatrist, and I interviewed returning POWs who had been subjected to Chinese communist thought reform, and I subsequently did a study of people coming out of China while I was in Hong Kong, and I interviewed them, and that was my larger study of thought reform and the book that I wrote about it. So, yes, and I had an article in that same journal that this now notorious Biedermann principles appeared.
So you were, in effect, your article was, in effect, a dissent from Biedermann, was it?
Well, let me put it this way. It wasn't necessarily in dissent from Biedermann. It was in dissent with the impulse on the part of some American intelligence groups to embrace so-called brainwashing. Biedermann simply listed a set of characteristics of Chinese thought reform or so-called brainwashing. The scandal that occurred was not Biedermann's report, but in subsequent impulses on the part of the American government to try to conduct its own version of brainwashing. And when I wrote about it, and I made this very clear and strong in my book, which was called Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, my point was this is a destructive psychological process. It does exist. It's not invulnerable. It's not something that can destroy all minds everywhere, but it is destructive to the minds of those subjected to it, and we should avoid it. We should recognize it and avoid it. But there was an opposite impulse on the part of some American official groups during the Cold War. They wanted it. Rather than seeking to avoid it, they wanted to embrace it and use it as a weapon. So in that sense, I was and am in radical dissent from those American impulses which are in the direction of embracing so-called brainwashing or thought reform.
Well, I think that gets to the heart of the problem, does it not, Dr. Robert J. Lifton? And that is that we have to assess the damage done to U.S. foreign policy and by torture and the erosion of our credibility in terms of human rights. The outgoing U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights effectively castigated the United States for what she said is a very serious erosion of safeguards against human rights abuses. And it's not that the United States has become the worst human rights abuser, but it has allowed people like Ahmadinejad, Robert Mugabe, the generals in Burma, you name it. They literally get away with murder now because they say, well, you know, the Americans do it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is a real scandal in terms of American experience. You know, if one were to say what is emblematic of the Vietnam War, it would be My Lai, the massacre of 500 civilians in one place in one morning. What is emblematic of the Iraq War is American involvement in torture. And here we've embraced Chinese communist methods that we initially criticized and saw as wrong. We've embraced them ourselves and allowed them to become part of a form of torture that we ourselves perpetrate. So that's the problem, ethically speaking. And I don't think one can understand how far we've gone in American degradation until we look fully at what we've done in relation to torture and in embracing others' techniques for torture.
Well, Dr. Robert J. Lifton, I don't know whether you saw the hearings that took place a little over a week ago before the House Judiciary Committee, where some of the architects of torture were on display, if you will, the most secretive of all, of course, being David Addington, Vice President Cheney's right-hand man, along with John Yoo, who was at the Justice Department and wrote some of the enabling memos. The problem with that hearing was the utter fecklessness of our Congress to get to the heart of the matter, maybe it has something to do with the state of our media, where it's not so much what you say, but how the press reports what you said.
It's also giving torture a kind of legalistic legitimacy. That's what those hearings showed. Unfortunately, it's not seen as a criminal offense to redefine torture in a way that encourages Americans to really take part in it. And that's what the government lawyers really did at that time. What was being revealed at those congressional hearings was the way in which policies put forward by ostensibly legal experts define torture so narrowly, only destruction of organ systems, as they put it, that we were encouraged, really almost made to commit torture as a policy. And this responsibility for this happening lies at the very top. I became interested in this process in how doctors became involved in torture, because I've been concerned about doctors' transgressions ever since my study of Nazi doctors. And, you know, American doctors at Abu Ghraib or other places were simply part of a process by which they're socialized to torture. They're drawn into a group process in which torture is the norm, and torture becomes the norm because of these legal documents put forward that encourage it and redefine it in the most narrow terms. And that kind of legal transgression should be recognized. And of course, it comes from the very top, because the Bush-Cheney administration encouraged and asked for these legal judgments.
So what happened to the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was studying Nazi doctors, I raised the issue of the Hippocratic Oath, and sometimes they would say, well, we also took an oath to Adolf Hitler. That this kind of claim of high nationalism and higher purpose and legitimacy, because it's the policy of your own country and your own leadership, is what leads to violation of the Hippocratic Oath or of any ethical behavior on the part of professionals. So it's not so difficult for professionals like other people to be drawn into destructive behavior where that becomes the norm in a particular environment. In my work, I call this an atrocity-producing situation. One can say that at Abu Ghraib, there existed an atrocity-producing situation, and that means that ordinary people, no better or worse than you or me, if they enter that environment, are capable of committing atrocities because the environment is so constructed militarily and psychologically to create that impulse.
Well, it has so much echoes of totalitarianism and the drift into a totalitarian state. I mean, you've got echoes of Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon and George Orwell's 1984, and of course that the Chinese euphemism for brainwashing, thought reform, more or less says it all. But now we have our own government.
Incidentally, the euphemism is brainwashing.
Oh, thought I see.
Thought reform is the actual term they use for a systematic process that they do, that they have implemented.
I see.
But
well, it has an Orwellian ring to it, you have to admit.
It does. It does indeed. And that's part of its attraction.
I see.
Because it has a kind of apocalyptic tone which becomes irresistible for some people who want to embrace what's an ultimate form of power, that of controlling human minds. It does have an Orwellian ring, I agree with you.
But then, now that we've seen with this testimony before the House Judiciary Committee just recently, that the United States government at the highest levels has been enabling and not just entertaining this stuff, they've been enabling it and even in an arrogant way defending it in the case of Addington, is it hyperbole to suggest that we have, that's the sort of face, if you will, of American fascism, or at least the incipient form of American fascism?
I'm not so sure I'd call it American fascism, but it's, as you put it before, it's an American embrace of totalitarian methods within a structure of a democratic system. And that's been characteristic of the Bush administration right along. Within the external structure of a democratic process, and there still is a democratic system which has had some restraint on this administration, but within that structure, there's an effort to control communication completely, and there's an effort to absolutize behavior on the basis of what's claimed to be a higher purpose. It's not quite fascism. It's an odd mixture of a democratic structure and its violation with totalitarian methods.
And just to digress slightly, though, because I'm mystified by how we live in a culture where belief is more important than fact, and it's extremely difficult to have political arguments today because a lot of people just don't believe in data. And it seems that one of the problems we have with our press, particularly with the legacy of Karl Rove, is that, for example, Al Gore never claimed that he invented the Internet. Howard Dean didn't scream. Hillary Clinton didn't say she was staying in the race because Barack Obama might be assassinated. And Wesley Clark didn't impugn John McCain's military service. Yet all of these things are what people believe. So is the truth, therefore, a moving target?
The truth is a moving target, but eventually it has a certain power. I can't remember seeing an administration that so distorted the truth and in a way didn't just put a spin on it, but reversed it. And that's what this administration has done repeatedly. And that, of course, makes ordinary people very skeptical about anything in the media. And the media become victimized by an impulse toward an interesting narrative or being themselves subservient to ultimate power and responsive to threats from the administration to the effect that they may lose access or something else like that, which is crucial to them. So we do have a great confusion about truth, and it becomes extremely important not to become simply cynical about this, but to confront it. And to confront every single violation of truth or reconstruction of truth. So here, the administration, even prior to embracing Chinese communist thought reform methods, has a certain affinity for thought reform in its own desire to construct and manipulate truth.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Robert J. Lifton, how again, in terms of the failure of our press, I'm mystified as to why nobody in the press has been able to pin down President Bush about his core beliefs, because his most ardent supporters believe in the rapture and the end of the world. And if you're the president of the United States and therefore the custodian of the environment, and you have your access to the nuclear button, it's a total conflict of interest if you believe that the world should end, in fact, in burning flesh, where we all die, so that those believers, and I assume the president is one of them, would rise up in the rapture. I mean, it seems to me a core question, and for the life of me, I've never understood why we've never been able to pin that down.
Well, one way of looking at this is to say that this administration is highly ideological and has an impulse toward totalism, toward totalistic ideology, including ideology of the rapture, as you're describing it. And there's a struggle between ideologizing every single issue and responding with a certain amount of pragmatism. So that, and right now, Condoleezza Rice is writing articles in Foreign Affairs about a new pragmatic turn in American policy. At times, she and others show signs of a little bit of restraint on the ideological extremity in the direction of pragmatism. The administration has been characterized by its ideological extremity and not much pragmatism, but now, in its waning days, we're seeing at least a struggle between the two, so that it might be hard to pin down an absolute position in regard to the rapture. One could say that there's a great influence on the administration on the part of right-wing fanatics who embrace a religious view of the rapture, and others who are more secular who might have less of this. There's also a danger, not just of the religious impulse, but of a radicalization of secular nationalism. There's really a fanatic American nationalism, which could have been more characteristic of Cheney and Rumsfeld and others of that ilk, who are not necessarily religiously fanatical. But you can be fanatical in a secular way in terms of American hegemony, and that's what I meant by superpower syndrome. Mm-hmm. It's a mix of a secular embrace of ultimate power and a religious embrace.
So apparently nobody's asked Condoleezza Rice how you can fight against religious fanatics abroad and be in bed with the religious fundamentalists at home.
Yeah, well, that's right. And the administration has a number of strange bedfellows in that way. And I think the administration itself has been torn and has had battles of this kind. The battles have usually been won by the extremists, but that may be a little less the situation now with the waning power of the administration and of some of the extremists within it.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Dr. Robert J. Lifton.
I've enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Dr. Robert J. Lifton, one of America's most acclaimed psychologists, known for his studies of the psychological causes and effects of war and political violence. And he, of course, was quoted in the article in the New York Times this week, China-inspired interrogations at Guantanamo. And he was involved in debriefing the American POWs from the Korean War who were brainwashed, or, as the Chinese put it, went through thought reform. I'm now speaking with Adam Isaacson, who's the director of the Columbia Program at the Center for International Policy, an independent research and advocacy organization in Washington, D.C., which monitors security and U.S. military assistance to Latin America and the Caribbean. And he has produced a number of publications on the subject, including Just the Facts website and a series of reference books on U.S. Latin American military cooperation. Adam Isaacson's study of U.S. policy and accompaniment of Colombia's peace process has brought him to Colombia over 30 times, including 12 of the country's 32 departments. And, of course, this week, Adam, we saw the spectacular rescue ruse by the Colombian military. There's been much speculation since about the future of the FARC and the extent to which people are suggesting it's disintegrating. First of all, what was your reaction to the rescue?
Well, I mean, like everyone else, my reaction was pure elation. I mean, those of us who had known a lot of the family members over the years and really kind of run into a brick wall trying to advocate for some sort of solution to get them out over the years, it was just amazing to see these images of them reunited. At the same time, also quite a bit of surprise. The family members had lived in grave fear that the Colombian military would attempt a rescue, you know, coming in with helicopter rotors chopping and guns blazing, because the FARC guerrillas, who are not great guys, are known for killing their captives at the first sign of a rescue, and they've done that in the past. Instead, though, the Colombian military pulled off a rather brilliant operation using a few intelligence agents posing as members of a humanitarian NGO that was going to help transport them to the FARC leadership to prepare for some sort of humanitarian exchange. And as it turned out, the ruse worked completely. They tricked the FARC into handing over their prize hostages. Pretty remarkable, and not something I would have expected from the Colombian military, which really, you know, it's gone through quite a process of reform, but still worldwide it's known best for its really poor human rights record. It's sort of like, you know, and to see them succeed that in that way, it was sort of like expecting like the Homeland Security's orange alert to somehow foil a terrorist plot. You know, sort of like that. Just not what you would have expected, but I'm very pleased that it worked and that 15 of the FARC's 40 exchange so-called... The FARC had been holding 40 civilians and military people to pressure for a prisoner exchange, and these people had been held for 5 to 10 years. 15 of those 40 are now free. 25, though, are still in the jungle.
Well, indeed, one of the Colombian commandos posed as an Australian journalist, and he was sort of doing a Crocodile Dundee version of Michael Ware, I think.
Apparently one was posing as a Frenchman and tried to spoke a few words of fake French to Ingrid Betancourt, and she didn't know what the heck was going on.
Well, we're going to be joined later in the program by Karen Hayes, who I think you know, who made the documentary, The Kidnapping of Ingrid Betancourt. She was she's in Paris, and she was actually with the two Betancourt children the day before of the release and with the family of Marc Gonzalez at the time of the release.
Wow, that's terrific.
So
I hope you got something on camera.
I think so, yes. So when you mentioned Adam Isaacson, the FARC strategy of taking prisoners as hostages, one's been led to believe that most of it was to do with ransom, like kidnapping. But obviously there was an element of protection on the part of the FARC against a commander raid, surely. If they're using these people as human shields and as a deterrent against the Colombian army coming in with guns blazing, it looks like it's worked, hasn't it?
To prevent them from coming in? Well, I mean, they were using, in general, I don't think the human shield theory really holds up because, in general, they were not holding the hostages in places where key leaders were. They were still in separate places. So there was nobody of great importance to shield. These camps were really just the hostages and the people who were guarding them. Maybe a front commander, but the FARC has about 60 fronts. So they were being kept in separate places. But as a strategy, though, this has been really the FARC's, a big part of the FARC's undoing. The FARC started in 1964 as sort of a Marxist-inspired peasant uprising trying to overthrow the oligarchy that has always run Colombia, but they really lost their way. They have systematically mistreated the people in rural areas who you would expect to be their political base. They relied way too heavily on money from the drug trade, which ultimately seemed to be some sort of a substitute for popular support. They're widely hated and feared, even among the people that you would expect to be supporting some sort of army of the poor. And the icing on the cake, or the thing that really did them in, was this practice of kidnapping. First, starting in the 1980s, they would kidnap people for ransom, which at some point came to make up about half of their income, less now because of their reliance on the drug trade. And then, starting the late 1990s, early 2000s, they came up with the strategy. For some reason, they thought it would make sense to start kidnapping regular Colombian civilians, politicians, even progressive politicians like Ingrid Betancourt, and just hold them for years and years and years under very cruel treatment, not even allow the Red Cross to visit them. The pressure for an exchange of prisoners to free some of the FARC prisoners in Colombian jails. And with that would presumably come some sort of political recognition because the Colombian government had to sit down with them. That has destroyed the FARC's international image. I mean, only a few people are left out there who would still view the FARC as some sort of romantic, revolutionary movement. And it certainly destroyed their image within Colombia. It's just been they've carried out these counterproductive strategies, and now that the Colombian government has started these rather sophisticated intelligence operations aimed more at their leadership than their rank and file, the FARC seem to really be in free fall. They may still be around for a while because the drug money can really sustain you for a long time, but their decline is pretty irreversible at this point.
Well, Adam Isaacson, I remember some time back interviewing the girlfriend of one of the young ecologists who went into FARC territory to visit the Indians who were protesting against Occidental Petroleum for spoiling their environment. And, of course, the FARC was blowing up the oil pipelines, which had hideous effects on the environment. We know that spraying for coca also has hideous effects on the environment. And the long and the short of it, they were captured by the FARC and murdered. I mean, to me, I can't understand the ideology. I mean, these had to be the most boneheaded Marxists that ever came along.
Probably. We are talking about, especially the generation that joined. I mean, we're talking about a very old guerrilla movement at this point. People who are, joined the guerrilla movement when they were 11 or 12 years old are now in their 40s, and that's what they've been raised as. And it ideology ultimately doesn't really enter into it. It becomes really just a language for your paranoia. And in the case of Terence Freitas and Ingrid Washinawatuk, the Americans who were killed in 1999 while accompanying the Uwa Indians, the FARC assumed that they were CIA agents. That's the level of paranoia that you're dealing with. Even then, this is at a time when the FARC was at the height of its power in Colombia.
Right. I suppose that one thing in the defense of the FARC, from what I understand from the history of the movement, wasn't it true that I think it was in the 70s that they were invited out of the jungle to come in and negotiate with the government, and when the guys came in and gave up their weapons, they were slaughtered?
That's an important point. For most of the 1980s, the FARC had declared a ceasefire with the Colombian government. They were in slow-moving negotiations. And as part of that, in the mid-1980s, the FARC endorsed or started a political party called the Patriotic Union. The Patriotic Union, a lot of these sort of more politically-minded, ideological, maybe less, you know, the ones who didn't fire shots in anger as often, members joined the Patriotic Union. They became candidates. Their presidential candidates didn't win, but did okay. They had senators and lots of mayors and councilmen all over the country. And then from the late 1980s to the early 1990s, factions of Colombia's military, funded by landowners and drug lords, in league with right-wing paramilitary death squads, killed as many as 3,000 members of the Patriotic Union. And that did two things to the FARC. First, it made clear that, you know, they weren't going to be able to do a Central America-style FMLN becomes a political party peace process, that they would have to keep their weapons and keep fighting. And second, it got rid of a whole generation of the FARC's best political minds. The people who were the political ideological thinkers were gone. And what was left was a sort of rump of people who were quite good at military tactics and were good at growing the organization and good at channeling the drug money into the struggle, but really not at getting any messages out or even considering sort of the consequences of their actions as far as their image and why they might need public support. And that explains sort of what you have left of the FARC today.
Well, of course, the President Uribe now, who's basking in the limelight, at his inauguration, the FARC lobbed mortar shells, did they not?
They sure did. And classic example again, they lobbed mortar shells at the presidential palace, missed, and instead most of those mortars landed in a very, very poor neighborhood populated mainly by sort of crack and basuco addicts a few blocks to the south of the presidential palace and killed about 14 of these indigent people. The collateral damage of the FARC's battles, once again being the poorest part of the country that you'd think they would want their support. That's been a really recurring theme with them, and it is one reason why the government has had such success. The FARC seemed to be low-hanging fruit with a strategy of just trying to get people to inform on the FARC, which they seem to be very willing to do if they feel that they're going to be protected, and also just convincing the FARC rank and file. The rank and file are about one-third minors, about 40% women, people who join largely just for a regular three square meals a day, convincing them to desert, and also convincing them that, unlike in the past, in the more abusive years for Colombia, that they wouldn't be tortured and disappeared if they deserted, but that they'd actually get job training and a stipend and hope for a new life. And that has worked brilliantly. It's worked much better than sort of the massive military offensives and the, as you mentioned, the massive aerial herbicide fumigation that makes up most of what the United States has paid for.
Well, the United States, because of, I think, $5 billion has gone into the Colombia. A lot of it's targeted for the war on drugs, in addition to the $400 million now going to Mexico.
Right.
And the United States has been spending $69 billion a year worldwide for the last 40 years on the war on drugs for a total of $2.5 trillion.
Incredible.
And when you think about how the FARC were getting money from the cartels, it's all about the money, and because we have this policy of prohibition, we've put this vast amount of money in play, which has had these incredibly detrimental effects on Colombia and Mexico and on the United States. Is anybody anywhere thinking about that fundamental dysfunction?
You don't hear a lot of politicians in the United States talking about harm reduction, much less legalization or anything like that. Although, I mean, the abject failure of playing Colombia as a counter-narcotic strategy, we have given Colombia $6.1 billion since 2000. Colombia is the fifth largest recipient of U.S. aid in the world, first outside the Middle East. 80% of that aid, $4.8 billion, or $17 a second, has gone to Colombia's security forces, and most of it, about three-quarters, has gone to the drug war. And the cocaine, the amount of cocaine being produced in Colombia hasn't changed. It may even be greater than it was in playing Colombia.
No, it's up 20. It's up 26% this year.
That's right. The coca plants that we're spraying so assiduously are actually increasing, which is just amazing and tells you a lot about the power of poverty in rural Colombia. That has been an abject failure, and I think that it creates a little more space for experimentation. But I wouldn't get too optimistic. But you will notice, though, that you know. In this presidential campaign in the United States, we've had debate after debate after debate, dozens of them. I don't remember, and I looked. I didn't see any questions from reporters or from the audience about drugs this year. It's just not in people's mind because the percentage of the population using drugs, and especially using cocaine from Colombia, which is sort of out of style at the moment, hasn't increased. So that does create room for people, especially at the local level, and especially if we have a more creative drug czar in a future administration, it'll create more room to try to just pursue some alternatives, some that maybe see drugs more as a public health issue at home and not something that you just have to, we have to sort of get out of the shock and awe phase of the drug war and try to figure out how to actually pursue strategies that work. And aren't going to look tough.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Adam Isaacson.
Thank you for inviting me.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye now.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Adam Isaacson, who's the director of the Columbia Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lick Duan, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.